But I just want to step out here so you can see just how far back this line goes. I mean, it's about 2 football fields here. Many of them saying they knew it was going to be a very big election, that it was critical, that there was going to be a lot of interest. They wanted to be one of the first people to cast their ballot. But we also heard about mistrust of the Postal Service. Take a listen to this.
Because I don't trust the mail right now. If I got to stand here all day, I'm going to vote today.
Virginia voter Jim O'Connor speaking to CNN's Kristen Holmes this morning. Early voting began today in Virginia and 3 other states, South Dakota, Wyoming, and Minnesota. Both President Trump and Joe Biden are campaigning in that state today. Even though an ABC News Washington Post poll out yesterday shows Biden with a 16-point lead over Trump in Minnesota. It's a much tighter race in Wisconsin. Both states have been rocked by protests in recent months after the deaths of George Floyd and Jacob Blake. We're going to talk about all this and the polling data now with Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for NBC News. Welcome back.
Great to join you.
Well, first of all, why are they both campaigning in Minnesota today if Biden looks like he has a lock on that state?
Biden looks like he has a lock on that state in the limited polls that have come out so far, but it hasn't been widely polled. And the main reason is that President Trump lost Minnesota by only 1.5 points in 2016. It is not as safe a Democratic state as, you know, the winning streak going back several decades would suggest. And it's one of a few limited paths that President Trump has to win the presidency. If you look at a world where the Sun Belt, states like Arizona and potentially Florida, could go Democrat, Trump needs Minnesota to win. And the reason he and his campaign think he has somewhat of a shot there is that Minnesota is a largely white state. It has a disproportionately high share of rural white voters who didn't go to college, which, you know, is the heart of Trump's base. It's not clear that that's enough, however, to make up for the overall Democratic tilt of Minnesota.
Well, you mentioned Arizona. A new poll out today from the New York Times says that Trump is down 9 points in Arizona. That is a lot, given the fact that this is and has been a traditionally Republican state. So why?
It's truly remarkable. Arizona is turning out to be the single biggest bright spot for the Democrats, I would argue, in the 2020 election. This is a state that has voted for a Democratic president just once, going all the way back to 1952. It is one of the most reliably Republican states historically, but thanks to demographic changes in the state and the fact that the suburbs, particularly around Phoenix and Maricopa County, have moved so decisively toward the Democrats, Joe Biden looks pretty good shape to win that state. Some of the polling averages show him doing even better there than he is in traditionally Democratic states like Michigan and Wisconsin that Democrats lost last time that need to, you know, that they need to win this time. And it's not only that. There's a Senate race there that could be very important, where the Democratic candidate Mark Kelly is consistently polling ahead of the incumbent Republican Senator Martha McSally. So Arizona certainly looking like a positive note for the Democrats in this cycle.
Right. Well, let's talk more about that Senate race. So Mark Kelly, former, he's the astronaut and Gabby Gifford's husband. So he is about, what, 8 points up ahead of Martha McSally. Why is the lead so big there between those two?
The latest polling averages show Mark Kelly leading by 6.7 points against Martha McSally, which, again, a really remarkable lead considering the fact that prior to 2018, Arizona had not elected a Democrat for the U.S. Senate in 30 years. Kyrsten Sinema beat Martha McSally in that state in the 2018 election. McSally would go on to be appointed by the governor to an open seat after that, so she became an incumbent. But it's a combination of things. It's a combination of what many Republicans lament, frankly, is a weak candidate in Martha McSally, who's not been a particularly strong campaigner. The fact that Mark Kelly is seen as a strong Democratic candidate who has hit the right notes in that state. He's run as a centrist, followed a similar kind of playbook as Kyrsten Sinema did in her successful 2018 race. And of course, you have the fact that these changes in voting patterns, the suburbs, particularly in Maricopa County, have moved toward Democrats, a trend that has been occurring throughout the Trump era. And you have a constellation of factors that is working against the Republicans this cycle in Arizona.
Yeah. And a big Latino voting base as well now there in Arizona. Let's go across the country to Maine. And what's happening there with veteran Senator Susan Collins? She is fighting for survival against a woman named Sarah Gideon. Tell us about that race.
Susan Collins appears to be in the toughest battle of her career as a senator of several decades now. She is facing Sarah Gideon, the Speaker of the Maine House, and a series of recent polls show Gideon ahead of Susan Collins. Now, Susan Collins' ace in the hole has been that for the duration of her career in Maine, she has won overwhelmingly strong support among independents by portraying herself as kind of a free-thinking person, someone who's not tied to the Republican Party quite as much as many of her colleagues are. This time, we're seeing the reverse happening. Independents have moved away from Susan Collins. This has come on the same year that she voted to acquit President Trump after his impeachment trial in the Senate. And I think President Trump's enormous unpopularity in Maine has proven to be a massive obstacle for Susan Collins, because she's had trouble triangulating her way out of that, kind of the way she was able to before President Trump came along.
Hmm. Yeah, so Biden is up 17 points in Maine. How big a millstone is Donald Trump around the necks of these vulnerable incumbents across the country?
It's enormous. The albatross around the necks of Republican candidates, particularly at the Senate level in 2020, is severe. And you see President Trump unpopular nationally. You see him unpopular in a number of these states. Maine is a particularly acute example because it's a Democratic-leaning state. And Susan Collins has only been able to win there because she's had a uniquely strong personal brand that's now, you know, been tarnished by the fact that she's had to she has supported many of President Trump's initiatives and aligned with him on many issues. Certainly not all, but many of them. Mm-hmm. And this is the trouble you see for Republican candidates across the board. They need Trump's base in order to have any path to winning re-election. But aligning themselves with Trump has a way of turning off independent voters who tend to make up the difference.
Right. And what about her vote for Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court? Is our voters holding that against her, too?
That is one of several issues on which she has sided with President Trump that, you know, that is coming back to haunt her. I think the vote to acquit him in the impeachment trial is one of them. She has also cast some votes against President Trump, most notably the vote to repeal the Affordable Care Act in 2017. She voted against that. She was one of the decisive votes that blocked that. So she has a more independent record than a number of her colleagues. But Kavanaugh is one example where she firmly sided with President Trump against an overwhelming sentiment among Democrats. And some polls that showed independent voters were not happy about that either. So she's suffering for that, yes.
So Democrats need at least 3 net gains to even it up in the Senate. And then if Biden wins, Kamala Harris could be the tie-breaking vote for the Democrats. Can they get that? Is that within the realm of possibility now?
It's certainly within the realm of possibility. It is far from assured. If you look at the House, the presidency, and the Senate, between those three, the Senate is going to be the toughest for Democrats to capture. And the landscape looks something like this. Overall, Democrats have a very friendly Senate map. They're only defending 12 seats. All but one are in safe territory. Republicans are defending 23 seats, many of them in competitive states. So the most competitive races at this point are Arizona with Martha McSally, Colorado with Cory Gardner as a Republican incumbent, Maine with Susan Collins, Montana, Steve Daines, should be a lock. This is a red state, but he's come under a serious challenge from the incumbent governor of that state, Steve Bullock, who's a popular Democrat, and then Tom Tillis in North Carolina.
Okay.
If Joe Biden wins the presidency, Democrats need a net gain of 3 seats. If Donald Trump holds onto the presidency, they need a net gain of 4 seats to capture control of the Senate.
All right. That's Sahil Kapoor of NBC News.
Great to be with you.
Well, today is the first ever National Black Voter Day. It's part of BET's hashtag Reclaim Your Vote campaign. The network teamed up with the National Urban League and dozens of other organizations to help register black voters. Joe Biden is taking full advantage. His campaign unveiled a series of virtual events today geared at black voters in swing states like Wisconsin, Georgia, North Carolina. Biden's counting on a big turnout among African Americans to defeat President Trump this November. Meanwhile, Republicans are said to be outspending Democrats with social media ads targeting black and Latino voters. Journalist Farai Chidea has covered every presidential election since 1996, and she's host of the brand new radio show and podcast called Our Body Politic, and it's geared at reaching women of color, and it launches next Sunday right here on KCRW. Farai joins me now. Welcome.
Hi, Madeline. It's great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Well, let's talk first about the presence of Kamala Harris on the ticket. And she's on a virtual tour of North Carolina to help energize black voters there. Is her presence enough to galvanize more votes for Joe Biden?
Well, you know, I think that it is for certain demographics. So Kamala, I'm 51. Kamala is 55. And sometimes people are like, oh, she'll bring in younger voters. Like, only in America is a 55-year-old politician considered someone who can bring in younger voters. I mean, no shade. We're both in our 50s, but...
Well, yeah. She's pretty youthful, though.
Oh, no, I agree. But I'm just saying, like, one of the things that we know is that it's a turnout game for younger voters. And although Kamala is obviously very youthful and amazingly dynamic, she's also a good 25 to 30 years older than some of the youngest voters. I only bring that up because framing is so many things. So I think Kamala Harris is very strong as an attraction for black women and many other women of color. She claims, as she should, her South Asian side as much as she claims her black side. Many South Asians and many other people are really excited about having someone who's both South Asian and black on the ticket. You know, I've interviewed her. She's definitely someone who has a real laser focus on the issue she cares about. And I think that it's helpful for black women in particular. And I know that one of the topics we want to possibly dive into is gender differences. So I think that it's also interesting to look at the virtual tour that candidates Biden and Harris are doing versus the in-person tours that candidate Trump, President Trump, is doing in some cases. In some cases, he's actually been blocked by states from having in-person rallies, but he's still trying to pursue doing in-person events during the pandemic as a show of, I think, autonomy and rebuffing, you know, science, et cetera.
Yeah. So and sort of projecting strength, or at least that's what he is trying to project, right? By saying, look, Joe Biden's too scared to come out of his basement. Not
right.
True, obviously, but that's the message that he's trying to give. How is that resonating with black and Latino voters, do you think?
You know, I don't know that black and Latino voters are as concerned either way about whether someone is in person or virtual. You know, I have spent quite a bit of time with black Trump voters. I spent part of the summer in a pandemic, you know, friends and family house with a woman who is a black Trump voter who bases her vote on religious conservatism. I think there are other people who base it on lower taxes. So no demographic is a monolith. And I think that President Trump definitely is appealing to more men of color than women of color.
Although black people are overwhelmingly Democratic, right? I mean, it's rare.
Oh, absolutely.
At least it was in the last couple of elections.
No, that's, I mean, it's exactly like I said. What I think is more the question is who actually turns up. And traditionally what you see is older black women are the super voters. Like, they show up, you know, hands down. But as you get younger and as you look at men, sometimes there's not as much of a commitment to voting. And younger is not just about black. It's like all younger voters.
Well, so you say that older black women are reliable voters at the polls, but now we have coronavirus in the mix. So what's your guess as to how that may impede, if it does at all, their desire to vote?
Well, desire and action are two different things. But, you know, I'm going to sneak peek something that we're going to have on a future show. We talked to a doctor who is talking about COVID and said that she's both a doctor and a consultant for other organizations that do healthcare. And she said that in one case, one of the organizations, when coronavirus hit, the Black and Latino employees showed up and a lot of the white employees called in sick. You can make of that what you will, but I think that a lot of women, including older Black women who may be most at risk for COVID, will show up because of their passion for civic service. And I hope that people are able to arrange to have proper, you know, PPE, and that the voting lines are not, I mean, one of the things we know is that voting lines in Black communities tend to be longer, and Black voters tend to be underserved by adequately staffed polling places. And in a time of coronavirus, that is more challenging than ever. So there are structural inequities, but Black people are used to dealing with structural inequities, and the pandemic is no exception. So I can't predict what percentage of people will stay home because of the coronavirus. But, you know, based on my years in the field, I think of a lot of the older kind of Southern church ladies who I interviewed in South Carolina during the primary in 2016, they're still going to turn up.
How do you gauge the enthusiasm level compared to 4 years ago?
You know, I can't. And what I mean by that is I've covered every election since 1996, and I've never felt as disconnected from public sentiment as I have this year, because of the virus, I haven't been traveling. Mm-hmm. Last cycle, I traveled extensively, and I saw the Trump voters' commitment to getting their candidate elected by being in the field. And I do feel that polling, which already had been compromised in various ways by the migration from landlines to cell phones and people's unwillingness to always answer pollsters, I have some concerns about the strength of polling in this cycle. But I also know that field reporting is compromised because it's just really dangerous. It's both dangerous to the reporters and to the subjects if done the wrong way. So I actually feel much less certain about what I know and don't know. And I would remind everyone that these are factors that journalists can't always control and pollsters can't always control.
Fry Chidea is host and creator of the new podcast and radio show, Our Body Politic, which will air on KCRW beginning next Sunday. Fry, thank you.
Thanks, Madeline.
Coming up, what the new galleries at LACMA look like. Frances Anderton is here with an inside peek. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. While we have been sheltering in place, a lot of activity has been going on at LACMA. Buildings have been demolished to make room for a $650 million new building by Swiss architect Peter Zumthor. Yesterday, the museum finally made public his plans. At the same time, activists released a letter demanding that one of the museum's trustees resign because of his ties to the prison industry. Here to talk about all of this is Frances Anderton, KCRW's resident design and architecture expert. Hi there.
Hello, Madeline.
Well, before we get to the redesign, what's gone? What's been bulldozed?
Gosh, well, three of the most original buildings, the Leo S. Bing Center, that was the theater, also the Hammer Building, and then the 1980s Art of the Americas Building. They've been completely removed, including their foundations. This has all been happening while many of us have been sheltering in place.
Right. So we had no idea this was going on. And now that LACMA looks like a pile of rubble, or a lot of it does, what will take its place? You saw these new drawings this week. What do they look like?
Well, as you know, this new building consists of what one could essentially call a kind of a boomerang shape that crosses Wilshire Boulevard somewhat controversially. In keeping with what Michael Govan has always proposed, the entire second floor of this boomerang-shaped building is going to be devoted to art. The ground floor, that is the floor level, is going to be the other activities of the museum, the shops, the education department, a theatre, and you will enter those off of what they hope will be this lovely kind of landscaped, flowing area. So if we go upstairs, that's the most important part, up to the second floor, and what you have is a fairly unusual arrangement for what has been known as an encyclopedic collection. You have around 20, you have about two dozen relatively small galleries. I say relatively small because they're not vast open halls. And those galleries, all of them rectangular or square, they sit amidst what one could call almost like a lake of circulation, where wander spaces. And those spaces will feel like pathways. They'll also open up into what feel like courtyards. Now, this approach has definitely elicited criticism. The critics will say the permanent collection held by LACMA needs to be shown permanently in large, gracious, hall-like spaces. However, what Michael Govan and his curatorial staff are trying to do, in his words, is keep up with new trends in curation, which is to kind of mix and match the art, a break from, in a way, what one might call the, I guess, Western-oriented approach to art collection and museum building. And so here's Michael describing how that is made manifest in the design.
You need a space that is flexible, where you can put any object from our collection with anything else. And you need to, for example, be able to show stone objects in light and works on paper in the dark in proximity. And we wanted a flow that allowed the visitor to make their own way through the museum. And so it's a balance of finding your way, but never getting lost.
Francis, what do you think? What is your professional opinion on what it looks like?
My professional opinion, I have to say, I feel like Solomon's baby, actually, kind of torn between opposing viewpoints on this building. I mean, it definitely repudiates an approach to displaying art. And there are definitely people who argue forcefully that this is a gigantic waste of space in a museum that is essentially a vanity project for Michael Govan and his chosen architect, Peter Zumthor. On the other hand, every building Peter Zumthor has designed is quite exquisite. He is someone who specializes in a sort of atmospheric, experiential approach to space. His palette is materials. It is light. It is silence. What he will likely create, if he has his way, is an experience where the concrete of these walls is going to be exquisite, where the black terrazzo floor will be perfectly chosen, where the bronze mullions that he plans for the glazing that surrounds the perimeter will be exquisite, where you won't hear the sound of air conditioning, where you won't be bombarded by ugly signs. That's the approach that Zumthor uses, and it will be a meditative experience, where you will have chance encounters with people as you bump into them, see them round corners. So that's the optimum Zumthor experience, and that is what we may get.
I have to say that idea of bumping into people, though, now seems a little fraught. So I guess he's assuming that all will be as it was pre-COVID by the time the museum opens, which is when exactly?
2024 is when he says it's going to be open. He says everything's on track. They've got the money there. He says they're even ahead of the curve with the construction because COVID has kept so much traffic off of the streets that they've been able to move ahead with the demolition faster than planned. So 2024, I would imagine, will be in a different era from COVID. However, what Michael Govan will tell you is that, in fact, the ground floor area where you wander through this landscaped park with the building essentially above you and you slip into the store or you slip into the restaurant, he says that's very helpful in a time of COVID because there's so much open air. The upstairs experience, yes, it is enclosed. I really assume we'll be in a different place. But frankly, that issue of being inside to see art would factor into any museum right now.
Okay, let's get to this other controversy. And this is calls for billionaire Tom Gores to be removed from his seat on the board. He is the owner of the Detroit Pistons, as well as a private equity firm in which has invested in some controversial projects. What's going on?
Well, two activist groups have written to Michael Govan, LACMA's director, calling for the removal of his trustee, Tom Gores, because of his connection with a prison communications company called Securus Technologies. Gores has a private equity firm that acquired this company in 2017. This company has become notorious, highly criticized for ripping off people in prison, charging a lot for prison phone calls. People say this represents essentially a racist practice, given that a disproportionate number of people in prison are people of color. So Michael Govan is being called upon to walk the talk and not have his board besmirched by people with this kind of association.
And what does he say about that, Govan?
Well, I did ask him in a conversation earlier today, and this letter has come so recently that he says he's not in a position yet to speak publicly because it has gone to the board. But I think he'd be okay with me characterizing his position and saying that they take this extremely seriously and, in his words, absolutely would conform to the county's anti-racism policies.
All right, Frances, thank you. Thanks for the LACMA update.
You're very welcome, Madeline. It's great to talk to you.
KCRW's Frances Anderton. She covers design and architecture. Coming up, how to make use of the tomato bounty these days.
Even when I'm canning, I usually end up getting an heirloom variety because I'm looking for flavor and I don't mind having to cook it a little more. And don't overlook cherry tomatoes. They make wonderful sauce.
Good Foods' Evan Kleiman is here next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
Bon appetit.
Where's the lamb sauce?
Creamy, salty, sweet, and oaky nuttiness.
15 minutes Bake Off Queens.
And then we add the whiskey. Boom! Flames.
Bam! That's a little bit like that.
Pie.
Okay, we're not going to talk about pie. We're going to talk about tomatoes because they are everywhere right now. And we're going to talk with someone who knows something about tomatoes and what to do with them. Evan Kleiman is here for our weekly Cooking with Evan food segment. She is, of course, host of KCRW's Good Food. Hi there.
Hello. Tomatoes.
Tomatoes. All right. So when you look out there at all the tomatoes there are on offer, let's say you're at the grocery store or the farmer's market, how do you pick the perfect tomato?
Okay, so if you want to pick the perfect tomato, I would definitely go to the farmer's market. Although even tomatoes in the grocery store are better during the summer than they are the rest of the year. But what I'm looking for is flavor more than a type of tomato. I know a lot of people who can make a lot of sauce look for romas because they're meatier. They have less water that you have to cook off before you can. But even when I'm canning, I usually end up getting an heirloom variety because I'm looking for flavor and I don't mind having to cook it a little more. And don't overlook cherry tomatoes. They make wonderful sauce.
Okay, so we're talking about sauce today and how to make it ourselves. What is the advantage to making it ourselves versus just buying a jar of it?
What making it yourself does is it allows you to really look for super excellent tomatoes, like maybe Cherokee purples, or it allows you to make a gorgeous, delicious, beautiful yellow sauce from those huge pineapple heirloom tomatoes. But I think that really you can't underestimate the power of really good olive oil when you're making your own sauce.
Mm-hmm. All right. So we are going to talk about making your own sauce. You have a very simple recipe.
Yeah, I mean, you know what's so interesting is a lot of people get really, not so much lazy, but people want to deal don't want to deal with peeling and seeding the tomatoes.
Yes,
personally,
I agree.
Personally, I never peel and seed them. I just chop them up. I throw them in a pan, and usually I don't use a tall, deep one. I use a wide, shallow one because I want evaporation to happen quickly. Hmm. I will chop the tomatoes up, add salt and a healthy glug of olive oil, and then I'll cover the pan and I'll cook it over medium high heat until all the water comes out of the tomatoes and it's nice and saucy. Then I remove the lid. I use my potato masher or a whisk to kind of break them up faster. And mm-hmm. then when they are reduced to my liking, I of course added some salt and some garlic. When they're reduced to my liking, then I just put them through a food mill, which I have and which is a super useful tool. It lets you run the tomatoes and all the sauce through the mill, and you turn it with your hand and it holds back the seeds and the skins. But you can take the skins out just by whisking with a whisk. If you take a whisk and you put it in with your sauce mm-hmm. and lift the whisk up, all the skins will be attached to it.
Oh, so you don't really need a food mill for this.
No, you don't need one. They're really super useful, but you don't need one, no. I mean, okay. You don't need hardly anything to really cook. And then if you do want to peel and seed your tomatoes, you can make a more chunky sauce. That's what I really love it for. So you just are going to throw your tomatoes in boiling water for a few seconds until the skin loosens, and you're going to remove them to a bowl of ice water, and then you're just going to slip the skins off. You cut them in half horizontally. You scoop out the seed, the little seed packets in the middle, chop them up, and then you just go ahead and make sauce the same way I just described.
What if you leave the skin and the seeds in there? What's going
to
happen?
Nothing bad will happen to you. You will have, in my opinion, the most flavorful sauce.
Oh.
Because
so all that effort is for naught? You should just keep all that stuff in there?
Well, I just think that the higher acid, in my opinion, resides in the seed cavity and just under the skin. Another really quick, easy way to do it, especially if you're pandemicking by yourself or with very few people, is you can grate the tomatoes into a pan. So let's say you have a really beautiful heirloom tomato that's nice and heavy and is big, and you cut it in half along the equator, and you just put some olive oil in a pan, then you take your grater and you just grate the tomato over the pan. And what happens is the skin doesn't catch on the grater. So eventually it'll just be your palm against the skin, taking every bit of meaty goodness into the pan.
Hmm. And how long can all of this keep, either frozen or in a jar in your fridge?
Well, frozen, it'll keep for a while. What happens is that it doesn't go bad. It just, the quality of it starts to diminish over time. I try and eat things that I have in my freezer within 6 months. I know a lot of places that you read say 3 months, but for me, that's just not realistic. If you do have a big refrigerator, another thing you can do is just freeze whole, beautiful, big heirloom tomatoes whole. And then when you're ready to make sauce, you just take a bag out of the freezer, and all of the cells will have been destroyed in the process of freezing the cell walls. So when it defrosts, all the tomato water comes pouring out. You can use that for cocktails or to make a tomato version of lemonade. And then it's really fast and easy to make sauce with those tomatoes that have been previously frozen.
So the idea that you should never put tomatoes in the fridge or the freezer, including the sauce, that's just hokum?
No, I mean, when I buy tomatoes, I don't put them in the refrigerator ever while I'm waiting, unless they start to get too ripe. And tomatoes will ferment within their skins when it's this hot. So if you have some ripe tomatoes or near ripe tomatoes and it's too hot in your house, I would definitely put them in the fridge.
All right, so you've made your sauce, you've done that part, and now you have to put it on something. Do you have recommendations for some really good pasta?
you know, for me, splurging on super high quality pasta is something that I do when I can. I can't always. And these are all dried pastas because I prefer dried pasta to fresh. That's a subject for another day. And a locally produced one that is excellent quality is semolina artisanal pasta made by Lia Ferrazzani. But if you really want to splurge and taste what the greatest dry pasta you could ever eat tastes like, the three I love the best are Martelli, I love Benedetto Cavalieri, and I love the brand Faela for the shorter cuts.
And where do you get those?
You can find all of them on Amazon, but some of the links I've given you allows you to also support small distributors that specialize in bringing in some of this high-quality stuff from Italy.
All right, and that's going to be on our website. It's on our website.
It's on our website. I made myself some spaghetti the other night from Martelli Spaghetti, and, you know, it's easy to forget that something as simple as spaghetti does have a quality differential.
That sounds like a really good meal. Homemade pasta sauce and these pastas.
Right.
Delicious. Who needs to travel to Italy?
Well, I do.
Yeah, me too. But
I'm about to swim there at this point.
Maybe this is second best. Evan Kleinman, host of KCRW's Good Food. You can find her tomato sauce recipes and her pasta recommendations at kcrw.com. Thanks, Evan.
Thank you, Madeline.
Coming up, we'll have your Friday film reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. As if life isn't enough of a horror show these days, today's Friday film reviews feature three scary movies and a documentary, which may serve as a little palate cleanser. Joining me for the reviews is William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcast Cancel Too Soon and the critically acclaimed network. Hey, Bibbs.
Hi.
And joining me, Sean Edwards, film critic and co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. Welcome back, Sean.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. Well, let's begin with Antebellum, starring Janelle Monáe, directed by Gerard Bush and Christopher Renz. And here's a bit from the trailer.
You're from Virginia, right? I can tell. You're special. You're not like the others.
Whoever you were before, that's over.
What are we doing? What is the plan?
All right, Sean, what is the plot of this movie?
Well, basically, Antebellum sort of functions as this neo-slave narrative that has some elements of sci-fi and horror. And basically, it's two movies in one. And it's really hard to talk about without giving away the plot, but it stars Janelle Monáe. And in her contemporary life, she's an author, a very successful author. And then in her other reality, she's trapped on a plantation and it's up to the viewer to figure out what the heck is going on. And this may be one of the most divisive films of the year.
Wow. Why is that?
Well, it's because it deals with, once again, the narrative of American slavery. And this one does something a little different that other films have not touched on. And this one sort of deals with sort of the horrific treatment of Black women during the time of American slavery and sexual exploitation. And this film has a lot to say about that, but it doesn't always successfully do so. I like what they were trying to do with this film. It's very ambitious. It's unflinching. At times it's tough to watch, but I think not a lot of it works because the two directors, this is their first feature film. And perhaps someone with a little more skill could have pulled this off, but I don't think anyone could have fully done it. It's a very tricky device to pull off. It's sort of Mandingo meets Get Out.
William, this sounds a lot like the Octavia Butler novel, Kindred. Is it based on that?
It is not. And boy, do I wish, you know, maybe it would have been, because that would be an incredible movie. But it goes off in its own direction. I actually found where it was going a little predictable, but your mileage might vary on that. I'm actually with Sean here in that there's actually a lot of excellent work within the film, and it's well shot and everything. But the problem is it's using the concept of taking America's horrifying history of slavery and treating it like a horror movie. And it's not really moving very far beyond that. There are way too many films that have tried to, when dealing with that subject, make it seem too cinematic or polished. And a movie that is just saying, no, this is horrifying, there's absolutely nothing whatsoever that isn't horrifying about it, and we're just going to treat it as a horror movie, that makes sense. But by marrying that historical premise to a storyline that also tackles where we are today politically, they open a big can of worms, and the plot just isn't interested in taking us there in a meaningful way. The plot's actually very straightforward once all the pieces are revealed. But I am interested in how the horror genre is tackling these issues of today. And we've seen films like Get Out or even The Hunt and now Antebellum that are taking, you know, they're trying to be extremely confrontational about what's going on right now in America. And sometimes they're going to completely whiff it. But this is the genre where we can be really confrontational about that. And Antebellum is confrontational in a way that few other films are at the moment, and that is at the very least interesting. But is the film itself great? No, I wouldn't say so.
Okay, moving on to another horror film starring a woman. It's called Alone, and this is about a young woman traveling alone, and she notices a guy following her. Here's a clip.
Where are you going?
I'm headed north.
911, what's your emergency?
I think I'm being followed.
I know you're close. Are you scared?
Please, just let me go.
Sean, I think we've seen this movie about 100,000 times before. Any surprises?
Absolutely, positively, no. I didn't like this movie. I don't understand how anyone can open their laptop and write the screenplay. It's just awfully hateful toward women. Like, are you serious? I mean, but the biggest thing about this movie is why? Why do we need this movie? Why does anyone need to see this movie? I just don't understand it. It doesn't make any sense. It's just like, it was just mean-spirited toward women. And it's problematic on a lot of levels. You just don't need this type of cinema.
Bibbs, what'd you think?
I'm not quite as harsh on this movie as Sean is, although I completely see his point. This is a movie that is actually kind of shockingly low concept. It's about a woman who is moving. She keeps running into a guy on the road, not in like kind of Duel, except we actually see who's in the cabin of the truck. And he eventually kidnaps her and she escapes. And it's stripping away a lot of the plot heavy artifice that we get in a lot of horror movies and just tries to like find the simple terror in what is, for the most part anyway, comparatively plausible about men who are hateful towards women attacking women. And that is absolutely horrifying. That is absolutely scary. And I will say this, I think John Hyams, who directed this, actually has a pretty deft hand and makes an efficient, well-crafted thriller. But again, here's a movie where the simplicity also undermines it, and I think that ultimately it also misses an opportunity to be more contemporary. This is a remake, so if you're interested in like survivalist thrillers, this might not be a complete watch for you.
Okay, let's move on then to The Devil All the Time. This stars Robert Pattinson and Tom Holland, and here's a bit from the trailer.
You ever think about how we ended up orphans living in the same house?
I know what my daddy did.
Blessed are they who hunger and thirst for righteousness.
That ain't no preacher. He's as bad as they got on the damn radio.
It is our delusions that lead us to sin. Delusions!
Okay, Sean. I think that was Robert Pattinson, I think.
Yes, you're absolutely correct. The Devil All the Time, which is awful most of the time, directed by Antonio Campos. He's a great director. I mean, this movie is skillfully done. The cinematography, the editing, the execution, the score, all of it works, except it doesn't work because all the characters are depraved. They're all unlikable. There's lots of meaningless violence. And then I didn't get into the casting. This is a film that suffers from poor casting choices. I didn't buy for a second Tom Holland's character. And you have to in order for this film to work. because he's the thread that sort of links everything together. And I was like, this guy wouldn't do any of this. And once again, here's another film where, man, it is not good for the women. They're used as tools. They're totally destroyed. They're butchered. I mean, man, what are we saying with these films? What are we saying as a society?
Bibbs, what do you think?
I actually disagree with Sean on this one. I actually think that there is a purpose to the violence, and I think that the fact that women are treated horribly throughout this narrative is a pretty strong indictment of the culture that the film is trying to depict. This is a film about how the seeds of evil ripple through a variety of communities in unpredictable ways. It all begins with one really terrible incident in World War II, and how that subtly and then eventually not so subtly affects the lives of dozens of people, all of whom are inclined towards violence and hate and using religion as an excuse to do the devil's work. And when you look at a film that takes, you know, the omnipresence of religion in a positive light and say like, oh, you know, here's the tree of life and here's all the beauty in the world. And then if you look at that as the opposite and focus on, you know, the devil all the time, what you're going to find is a film about the ugliness of society and the ugliness that we perpetrate on each other and the ugliness that we end up becoming a part of a never-ending cycle of, which is why Tom Holland ends up making all those choices. It's not because they're rational. It's because he was raised in an irrational and immoral universe. And I actually found that extremely compelling and exciting to watch. And it's a downer. You know, it's a depressing film in a lot of ways, but it's not a film that exists just to be a thriller like Alone or to an extent Antebellum, and it's not actually addressing the issues that it has. All the issues are right there, and it is a pretty powerful, I think, indictment of how hateful and how misogynistic and how, from a religious perspective, manipulative and hypocritical America's past has been. And so I actually thought it was really quite excellent.
And do we buy Robert Pattinson as the creepy preacher?
He's very creepy.
He's creepy. Whether or not I bought into it, only if it was on sale.
Okay, let's move on to something lighter, something completely different. This is a documentary called The Way I See It. It's about Pete Souza, who was the official photographer for both the Obama and Reagan administrations, directed by Don Porter. And here's a clip from the trailer.
Pete was with the president all the time.
Unlike his predecessor, Mr. Trump does not allow his staff photographer to capture photographs of life and work inside the White House.
If you just stacked up the images of the Obama presidency and the Trump presidency, you would see the two stories of America in the starkest possible contrast.
Okay, Sean, you saw this one. Pete Souza, official photographer for Obama, has also had quite a Twitter following because he uses it to really criticize President Trump with photos that speak to the opposite of what Trump says or does. He seems to have a photo for every tweet. So talk about this documentary. Is it good?
Yes, documentary is very good. And the part about where he sort of becomes a social media superstar is reserved toward the end of the documentary, which is a good thing because the entire documentary is not about that, which is what made The Way I See It so fascinating, because he actually talks about the two presidents in which he photographed for, which the first was Ronald Reagan during the 1980s, and then later President Barack Obama. So I found that fascinating because there was a lot of contrast and comparison between the two presidents and how he photographed them. And you got a, you know, a sense of what their lives were like behind the scenes. And if you are a political junkie, you will find that tremendously fascinating. As the movie drifts towards its conclusion, it sort of becomes less of a documentary and more of a love letter for Barack Obama, which I get, but I didn't get. But it also plays into the title The Way I See It, because there's some things that unfold in the documentary where you go, oh, I get what she's trying to do. I liked it. I just liked it because it provided us a glimpse of, you know, what history's been like. The photos that you get to see are amazing. And you hear a lot from Pete Souza, and he's gifted. He's a great storyteller, and he tells his story very well. And it maintains its partisanship for most of the documentary, which is a good thing, because depending on what side of the aisle you fall on, you may view this documentary differently. But I think by the time it concludes, it did what it was supposed to do. And it's well done. I mean, it's not the best documentary I've ever seen, but hey, it was definitely a great way to end the week, particularly after the three films I watched before I watched this.
Okay. All right. So you liked one of the movies. Bibbs, you liked one as well.
Yeah.
I'm split on Antebellum. Antebellum.
Yeah. Antebellum isn't a complete wash. I don't think it really works. But for me, I think The Devil All the Time is a winner.
All right. So at least we have something to do this weekend. So thank you both so much for those recommendations.
Thank you.
No, thank you very much.
Sean Edwards, film critic for Fox TV in Kansas City, also the co-founder of the African American Film Critics Association. William Bibbiani, film critic and co-host of the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and the Critically Acclaimed Network. And that's it for us this week on Press Play. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you on Monday.